Hello, Breakfast Club members. My name is Craig. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Craig. Are you ready?
And I just like my sponsor did for me on the fourth step, I'd like to stop and pause for a moment of prayer. God, relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will, that I may show of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. All right. Well, what it was like. I grew up in Paterson, I grew up in Toto, which is Paterson, New Jersey, is where I was born. About a year and a half later, I was moved to the next town over in Totowa, Totowa Indians, like, and this is Cherokee County. So apparently Indians lived there at one time, and they have Indian heads on the side of the police car, to remind us that, that I grew up in a town that was occupied by Indians at one time. So, and then here I am living in another town that was occupied by Indians. Okay. So, now, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and this is during racial times. This is like, for a black person to move into my neighborhood, it was a big thing. It was an all-white neighborhood, and a black person moved in, and everybody, they were having riots and everything, and me, I didn't care. Black, white, yellow, green, right from the beginning, I didn't really have racial boundaries, but I grew up in a world where there were racial boundaries. And I began to see a lot of differences between people. And instead of seeing the similarities, I saw the differences. And that's what I was being taught by society, to look at the differences, not look at the similarities. So, at 12 years old, I proceeded to get drunk, and I drank a half bottle of Irish whiskey, and I got very drunk. I had blackouts. Cops came to the house, and I was trying to crawl out the basement window, and they said the cops left, and I came back up upstairs, and then two guys had to basically, help me walk home, and they dropped me in the middle of my living room, and I looked up at the ceiling, and everything was spinning. So that was my first great experience with alcohol. And, I thought it was pretty cool. I threw up, and I had fun, and throwing up, and blacking out, and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought, well, gee, what a neat thing. And now here I am, beginning to invite people over the house, and we're starting to drink at the house, and my mom and my dad were both avid drinkers and so on. But, right about that time, when I should say at 12 years old, right, my dad had left when I was 11, so I didn't, I already had abandonment issues right from the get-go, right from the get-go. So, my brother was very, he's 2.5 years older than me, and we used to fight all the time, and I was always the antagonist and picking on him, and then one day my dad said to him, well, hit him back, he didn't want to hit me back, so he chased me down the street, got me on the ground, started pounding me in the face, and I said stop, and that was it, and then all of a sudden we respected each other's boundaries after that. Well, there were kids that were growing up on the street, the Russian that moved in the neighborhood, and he was kind of like a neat guy, and we kind of hung out together, the brothers, the Russian brothers, and he played an accordion real well, and he got a job working at the pharmacy, and he began to bring home some black beauties and white crosses, and we began to partake of this great adventure called speeding. And we used to go play pool, and we used to get on taking speed, and And I used to win some pool games, you know, because I would be on. You know, we did a lot of dangerous things, driving while high and came very close to other vehicles and daring and going down to the river and drinking and, you know, going out in the woods and drinking and, you know, and it was a very, it was like a big adventure. Well, he finally started getting into heroin and so on and so forth, and some more meth, and he ended up like a skeleton later on. You know, he disappeared for 2 years, and then he showed up, and he was like a skeleton sitting on his car, telling me how great his life was. You know, at that particular point, you know, I proceeded to, I think at 18, I became a born again Christian, and then I went back out to drink and smoke pot and so on and so forth. And then at 21, I got involved with a group called the Forever Family, and and I studied the Bible from 8 o'clock at night until like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I did it faithfully every day for 6 months. And at 22, I left that group, and then I had gotten married in the meantime. And I managed to stay sober for, at least I thought I stayed sober for 15 years. You know, I drank on holidays only. You know, I managed to escape all the drugs and the alcohol through the Bible and through a prayer group and through, you know, religious group. Not so religious. Actually, the guy that led the group was the one of the people on the Manhattan Project. I was going through a divorce at the time. His name was Stuart Trail, and he was trying to help people that were on the streets drinking and drugging. And I happened to get involved in that group. And we did the things like go out and cast out devils and out of people and all kinds of weird stuff. Watch people struggle. Try and help them. But now, so here I am, I'm this clean and sober, supposedly clean and sober person for like 15 years. And, I land that good job, and I'm making like $1,500 a week. I made as much as $6,000 one week selling gourmet restaurant food. And I was doing good. I got married. Meanwhile, I've been through another, I got a divorce when I was like 23, moved to California, got involved with another religious group out there, a non-denominational Holy Spirit-filled church for a while. And I was an apartment manager out there for like 5 or 6 years. And I got a degree in business administration, and then I moved back to New Jersey. And, then I ended up in Connecticut where my brother was, all of a sudden, I got this wealth, and, I was doing well, and all of a sudden, now I deserve the drink. I can go to a bar and I can sit down and I can drink and I could be like normal people. Well, I didn't know I was an alcoholic and an addict. I didn't know that. So all of a sudden I met this guy in a bar and he wanted to smoke some crack, and the next thing you know is I'm off to the races. And now I'm hitting, like big time, I'm really going full strength, So, as the story goes, many detoxes, many rehabs. Finally, I got caught in New Jersey, and they busted me and they threw me in jail, and I got 5 years probation for possession. But I didn't have a problem. See, I didn't have a problem. I just was having fun. Like I did when I was 12 years old, getting drunk and going crazy and thinking I was having fun. So I never really grew up emotionally, mentally, spiritually, in any sense of the word. So here I am, hitting meetings. I remember my first meeting when you were carrying everything. I lost the condo, I lost the car, I lost the wife and the kid that was just born. She went back to live with her mother, and they're carrying my stuff out of my condo and putting it in public storage, and I was sitting on the curb thinking, how could this happen to me? Of all the people in the world, a Christian that believes the way I do, how could this happen to me? You know? And some guy saw me and said, hey, if you think you got a problem, there's an AA meeting down the street over here. Now God's popping up on the scene. He says, are you done yet? You know? And I'm going like, oh my God, you know, now there's this meeting. And I went to this meeting and I couldn't believe it. Everybody was happy, joyous and free without drugs and alcohol. And, you know, and I began to believe again that there was a way out of the insanity and the mess that I had created of my life through drugs and alcohol. And I have to say drugs was a part of it. And I shot up dope once, but I did just about every other drug, you know, up until age 21, you know. But it became drug, I became a crackaholic at age 37. You know. And this went on for years, man. In and out, 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 because I didn't get it. I didn't know I had an obsession of the mind and the body. That once I put that drug or that alcohol inside of me, I was off to the races. I had no mental defense against the first one. There was some power greater than myself in that picture, but I didn't see it. I couldn't see that power. I didn't understand that power. All I know is that I wanted to have fun, and I was doing it the wrong way. So finally, you know, they stay there, you know, I move to Brooklyn, I'm there for about 10 years, I get involved in NA, and I managed to get together a year at one point, and then I put together 5 years, 5 months, and 4 days, and then I went back out. So, I still got a problem, I still thought that I could manage this alcohol problem, or this drug problem. I thought I could still manage it. And obviously, God was telling me something different. No, you cannot manage your own life, you know. You cannot live and enjoy life as other people do. You know, I had to have something different, right? And here I had to find an easier, softer way. So what did AA do for me? So now I'm here in Connecticut. I moved down to Connecticut. I drop everything in Brooklyn. I'm back out there again, another 2.5 years of misery, and I'm here. And, you know, and I slipped again when I got here. I slipped. And I ended up getting put in jail. And they gave me a 6 months probation and a dead document situation, since they didn't know about my other arrest in New Jersey. So that was good for me. I was getting off easy. And I came in here because I was tired of the consequences. I was tired of living the way I was living. And I didn't want to live that way no more. So I started coming to meetings here. I was like a dry drunk for about, you know, 6 months to a year. And then finally, after getting kicked out of my house by DFACS for yelling at my kids, because I was still an angry individual. I still wasn't dealing with the core problem, me. You know, I still wasn't getting down to the exact nature of my wrongs, me. I still wasn't dealing with the real deal, which was me. And then I found a sponsor that said, are you looking for the space between your thoughts? And then I got involved with that sponsor. Most of you know him. His name is Damon. And then he began to take me right. He saw I already surrendered on the first three steps. I can't, he can, I think I'll let you. And I began to let him, you know, his higher power working as he was a channel of that higher power to work in my life. And I began to trust that what he was doing in his life that was working for him would work in my life and work for me. And I began to believe that if I did as he did, that I would get what he got. And that's what I did. You know, I if he said stand on my head in the corner, I stood on my head in the corner because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I did not want to live that way no more. And, you know, he told me to sweep up cigarette butts out there. So now here I am, I'm homeless. I just bought the house down there in Canton. And now DFACS kicks me out, and they're telling me if I'm a good boy, I might get back into my house in 6 months. Most people take about 2 years. And I'm talking to everybody, I'm telling everybody my problems here in AA now. This is my situation. This is my circumstances. This is what I'm going through. I'm such a victim. Help me out. Help me out. I'm a victim. I'm a victim. I'm a victim. Help me. And they're saying, hey, with DFAC, you're going to have to jump through hoops. If they say you have to take drug and alcohol classes, if they say you have to take anger management classes, if they say you have to take parenting classes, you take them. You do whatever they tell you to do. You know? And I was always complaining. Complain, complain, complain. Poor me, poor me. And a lot of people heard me complaining. You know what I mean? Here comes Craig again. Poor me. It's amazing I didn't pour me another drink. So, here I was, Mr. Poor Me, and my story, and my problems, and my issues that I created in my life, asking for help. No longer being the great I am in my life. Surrendering my life to the will of God, and trusting that God's will be done in my life, and that I have to stop playing God, and let other people help me. Holy smoke, what a blow to my ego. I didn't want to live that way. But the more I surrendered my ego, and the more I surrendered my pride, and the more I swallowed it, and the more I took whatever came my way, the better it got. You know, they say fear. I was in a lot of fear when I got here. They used to say, F everything and run. Forget everything and run. You know, or false evidence appearing real, because that was my mind trying to tell me, this is real, this is going to screw you up, that person's going to screw you over, this person's going to mess, you're going to make a mess out of your life. You know, that was the false evidence appearing real, but it wasn't real, you know. Somehow I thought I was morally superior to reality. You know, and I wasn't. You know, I wasn't any better than anybody else in this place. I was just a generic, run-of-the-mill alcoholic with a drug addiction as well. And what I needed was spiritual principles to guide me and take me out of the bondage of self. And I had a sponsor that took me through the fourth step that showed me that by doing the fourth step in my life, by doing a fearless and moral inventory, and I'm telling you, I had a lot of fear doing this, man. I didn't want to look at my stuff. I didn't want to look at it. But as I began to look at it, the pain, here comes the pain, the one that gives me so much identity. You know, the one that says, poor me, you know, pour me another drink. Man, I lived in so much pain and fear. I was running in fear. I was running in pain. And all addiction starts with pain and ends with pain. And then a cycle starts all over again. That was what I was running from. But face everything and recover? Uh-uh. That, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to face my fears. I didn't want to face my past. You know, I can bring up my past, boy. I can bring up some real painful past issues, and I can form an identity about it and say, oh, man, I'm such a victim. But by doing the fourth step, I realized that I was playing the victim. I was playing the victim all my life. I was a victim of circumstances. I never knew how to take responsibility for my life. I never knew how to take responsibility for my feelings, my thoughts, and my actions. I was a victim. But today I'm a volunteer. If I want more pain, I know how to volunteer for it. You know? So now I've learned to let go of that false self, that make-believe phantom self that wants to masquerade as some victim. You know? And he wasn't even real. He was just something I created to give myself some kind of substance or to develop some kind of reality for myself. You know, like I'm somebody. But I was nobody. I was no better than anybody else. I found that I was just like everybody else when I did the fourth step. I said, man, I'm human just like you. I make mistakes just like you. You know, and now I've learned to forgive myself because I did that fourth step. You know, and I shared it with my sponsor. When my sponsor didn't react and judge me and when I shared it with him, I was surprised. I said, gee, surely God was going to punish me for this. And I was just waiting for you to do it for him. Man, I punished myself more than I punished anybody else in the world. I'm telling you, I really punished myself. I don't need to punish myself anymore. I got to stop punishing myself. You know? So then it says we are entirely ready to have God remove all he's got. You know, my sponsor kept it real simple for me because I'm a complicated alcoholic. I said, well, what do I do now? Well, look, you stay humble in the process. You know, humility was a way of life here. Humility means that, hey, you don't go back out there and trying to prove like you're somebody and you're nothing. You know, you stay humble and let God do the work in your life. So I said, oh, okay, that's an interesting concept. I'm going to stay humble and I'm going to let God work in my life. And he's going to remove the defects of character. I don't have to worry about it. All I have to do is keep doing the next right thing. Put my left foot in front of the left foot. Let go and let God. It'll work itself out. Everything that these people said in the rooms was true. It began to work itself out. And then when, you know, it says, well, made a list of offering. Well, okay, I made an amends to my daughter. And I told her I was wrong for being a crackhead alcoholic and for not being there for her while she grew up. I just found out my daughter got molested while I was out there drinking and drugging by my ex-wife's new boyfriend. What a horrible thing. I made an amend to her, and she told me that. That's horrible. And there's a lot of guilt, shame, and remorse over that. Well, you know, I forgive myself. I made a mistake, and I'm a resource to her today. I'm trying to be there for her. You know, whereas I couldn't be there for her before, you know, I'm there for her now. I'm a resource to her. Whatever information I can give her or let her know that, hey, life happens. You know, I might have been emotionally damaged growing up. I might have weird things happen to me when I was young, which I did, plenty of them. And I told her about them, and that helped her surrender and accept the fact that, hey, we're human. Stuff's going to happen, but I've got to take responsibility for my life today. You know what I mean? I can't allow those things to continue in my life. If I'm going to live sober, I got to take responsibility for my life. So I did those things. I made amends to her. I made amends to my brother. My brother called me on the phone yesterday, and he said, gee, Craig, you know, I found that sweater that you gave me when you got out of Arms Acres, this rehab upstate New York, you know, and I'm wearing it today, and your name came up, and, you know, blah, 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 and he's an AA right now. Well, he's got like 3 or 4 years or so, you know, and God's working in his life. You know, good things are happening. You know what I mean? So, you know, I'm gonna go to what ended off with this paper because my there's a guy over there. He's my co-sponsee and he gave this thing. He says, thoughts from Bill W. says, we are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. We of AA obey spiritual principles, at first because we must, then because we ought to, and ultimately because we love the kind of life such obedience brings. Great sufferings and great love are AA's disciplinarians. We need no others. It is when we try to make our will conform with God's that we begin to use it rightly. To all of us, this was a great and wonderful revelation. Our whole trouble had been the misuse of willpower. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of attempting to bring it into agreement with God's intention for us. To make this increasingly possible is the purpose of AA's 12 steps. When I was driven to my knees by alcohol, I was made ready to ask for the gift of faith. All was changed. Never again, my pains and problems notwithstanding, would I experience my former desolation. I saw the universe to be lighted by God's love. I was alone no more. We discovered the best possible source of emotional stability to be God Himself. We found that dependence upon His perfect justice, forgiveness, and love was healthy, and that it would work when nothing else would. If we really depended upon God, we couldn't very well play God to our fellows, nor would we feel the urge to rely wholly on human protection and care. Those of us who had come to make regular use of prayer would no more do without it than we would refuse air, food, and sunshine. For the same reason, when we refuse air, light, or food, that means resistance to life, the body suffers. When we turn away from meditation and prayer, we likewise deprive our minds and our emotions and the institutions of virtually needed support. As the body can fail its purpose for lack of nourishment, so can the soul. We all need the light of God's reality, the nourishment of His strength, and the atmosphere of His grace. To an amazing extent, the facts of AA's life confirm this ageless truth. We admitted we couldn't lick alcohol with our own remaining resources. And so we accepted the further fact that dependence upon a higher power, if only our AA group, could do this hitherto impossible job. The moment we were able to accept these facts fully, our release from alcohol compulsion had begun. For most of us, this pair of acceptances had required a lot of exertion to achieve. Our whole treasured philosophy of self-sufficiency had to be cast aside. This had not been done with sheer willpower. It came instead as a result of developing the willingness to accept these new facts of living. We neither ran nor fought, but accept we did. And then we began to be free. Beyond a higher power, each of us may vision Him, God, AA, must never as a society enter a field of dogma or theology. We can never become a religion that, in the sense, lest we kill our usefulness by getting bogged down in theological contention. The really amazing fact about AA is that all religions see in our program a resemblance to themselves. For example, Catholic theologians declare our 12 steps to be the exact accord with their Ignatian exercises for retreat. Now, looking through the Quaker eyes, you too see us favorably. What happy circumstances are these? Only through utter defeat were we able to take our first steps towards liberation and strength. Our admission of personal powerlessness finally turned out to be a firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives may be built. It was only when I came fully to believe that I was powerless over alcohol, only when I appealed to God who just might exist, that I experienced a spiritual awakening. This freedom-giving experience came first, and then faith followed afterward, a gift indeed. On studying the 12 steps, many have exclaimed, "One in order, can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. You know, I didn't become drunk overnight. I ain't going to get, you know, understand this program overnight. So it takes one day at a time. Though many theologians hold that sudden spiritual experiences amount to a special distinction, if not a divine appointment of some sort, I question this view. Every human being, no matter what his intention for good or evil, is a part of the divine spiritual economy. Therefore, each of us has his place for all of us to accept whatever positive gifts we receive with a deep humility, always bearing in mind that our negative attitudes were first necessary as a means of reducing us to such a state that we would be ready for a gift of the positive one via the conversation experience. Your alcoholism and the immense ego deflation that finally resulted are indeed the foundation upon which your spiritual experience rests. You are asking yourself, as all of us must, who am I? Where am I? Whence do I go? The process of enlightenment is usually slow, but in the end, our seeking always brings a finding. These great mysteries are, after all, enshrined in complete simplicity. The willingness to grow is the essence of all spiritual development. Those of us who have spent much time in the world of spiritual make-believe have eventually seen the childishness of it. This dream world has been replaced by a great sense of purpose, accompanied by a growing consciousness of the power of God in our lives. We have come to believe He would like us to keep our heads in the clouds with Him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. Our spiritual and emotional growth in AA does not depend so deeply upon success as it does upon our failures and setbacks. If you will bear this in mind, I think that your slip will have the effect of kicking you upstairs instead of down. We AAs have no better teacher than old man adversity, except in those cases where we refuse to let him teach us. Most conversational experiences, whatever their variety, do have a common denominator of ego collapse at death. The individual faces an impossible dilemma. In my case, the dilemma had been created by compulsive drinking, the deep feeling of hopelessness, and had been vastly deepened by my doctor. It was deepened still more by my alcoholic friend when he acquainted me with your verdict of hopelessness, respecting whatever. In the wake of my spiritual experience, there came a vision of a society of alcoholics. This must be Bill speaking. If each sufferer were to carry the news of the scientific hopelessness of alcoholism to each new prospect, he must be able to lay every newcomer wide open to a transforming spiritual experience. This concept proved to be the foundation of such success as AA has since achieved. Going alone in spiritual matters is dangerous. People of very high spiritual development almost always insist on checking with friends or spiritual advisors the guidance they feel they have received from God. While the comment or advice of others
may not be infallible, it is likely to be far more specific than any direct guidance we may receive while we are still inexperienced in establishing contact with a power greater than ourselves. And then the last part of it is prayer. One of the best definitions of prayer is one of catechism, or whatever it is. Prayer is the raising of the mind and heart to God. Better perhaps to say, prayer is trying to raise our minds and hearts to God. If we find that our minds are filled with thoughts that are holy, and that if our hearts are moved to want God and to want what He wants, then that is His doing and not ours. It is His gift. Our part in prayer is to try and raise our minds and heart, to spend time making the effort, trying to pray is prayer, and it is very good prayer. The will to try is also His gift. The word awareness is connected with the word struggling of the mind to concentrate on God. We are trying to be aware of Him, His promise, His closeness. The word desiring or wanting explains the action of the heart as it struggles to want God. Very often we can desire God, want Him, and our minds can either quit vacant or full of distractions. That desiring of God can become very strong indeed. Desiring without being able to think about God, that too is excellent prayer. So praying is trying to be aware of God and being aware of Him, to desire Him, to want Him. As I desire Him more and more, I become increasingly more aware. You know, all this stuff that God gives us in this program is amazing. And, you know, I still have my religious beliefs. And, you know, and I like what Jesus said. It said that the devil would surely likely you to believe that surely there is, that this is God paying you back. And that's what kept me sick out there. Said it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, he was saying. Your thinking is very narrow. Be enlightened. This happened that the works of God might be displayed. So everyone here is a miracle. That when you come in here and you get this program and you begin to work it in your life, you're doing God's will. And when you're not working it, you have a chance to be enlightened and to find a new way of life. So thanks for letting me share.